Welcome to episode 16 of the Never Iron Anything podcast. This podcast has been created to keep you occupied during the virus lockdown, which you're about to hear might be lifted, but who knows. My name's Tony Esmond, writer of The Whore Chronicles, Monster Spotters Club and Atomic Hercules. Today we have a writer, an artist and a computer games maestro who is here to talk comics and the movies that inspired them. Yes, it is my buddy Jason Wilson. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Tony. Good to hear from you on this these strange days we're living through right now.
It's strange, isn't it? Yeah. I know we Skype occasionally, don't we, to have a chat just to keep a bit of, well, talking to you, between you and I is never normal, but to keep a value of normalcy between us, yeah.
We do indeed. We talk about a lot of very obscure, strange movies
we do.
From Italy.
Yeah, so which kind of leads us into what is about today. So the aim of this episode is to give you an overview of a single horror comics magazine with art by a single artist that relates to the horror films of the, well, I suppose the, when was the Quite a Mess Experiment? Was that the 60s or the 50s? I'm not sure.
It was the 1950s when it was first on television, and then Hammer,
that's right,
made the movie adaptation.
Yeah, that's it. And also a vampire movie, which I'm sure we'll get to in a minute. Did you want to tell the listeners what we're talking about today, Jace?
Today we're talking about possibly my favourite comic artist, and his favourite comic artist of yesteryear, and that's Brian Lewis.
Yes. So we got very excited about this, and you and I both spent probably a month's wages on a number of books in relation to this magazine. But we decided, rather than talk about a whole shelf of comics and comic strips and articles and stuff, we'd focus in on one thing, which is the Halls of Horror All Comics Winter Special, which is a quality magazine. Oh dear, Des. From 1982 by Quality Communications, and it is a reprint, isn't it? Because we'll talk about Brian Lewis in a minute, but he died by this point.
Yeah, unfortunately, he died very young at the age of 49 in 1979, I believe it was. So yes, died criminally young. I mean,
yeah,
the guy would have gone to, I'm sure, great things with the boom of the kind of what was called the British invasion of America in the late mid 80s. Died very, very young.
Yeah, he was. I mean, fairly prolific, but in all different areas, I'm going to say. It depends. Mm. It depends where you're from, in what sort of area of comics or even novel fandom you're in, where you would know him from. But he's Brian Moncrief Lewis, which I know is also your middle name, Jace. he was born in Medway, I believe. His first published work was in the Medway Journal. He served in the RAF, and upon being, I think it was like National Service back then, I'm going to guess.
Yes.
He was demobbed from National Service and was involved in the science fiction fandom in the UK. His first professional work was a piece for the Radio Times, Journey into Space. And then he began contributing to the Nova group of titles. He did 40 covers for New World, which was, I think I'm right in saying it was like a short story, sort of a pulpy sci-fi kind of thing, was it?
Like an Astounding Fictions type anthology paperbacks that were very popular in the 50s and 60s.
And he did 21 covers for Science Fiction Adventures. He was, all you got to do is look at those covers, but he has actually said that he was influenced by surrealists, Max Ernst, for example, and illustrator Richard Powers. His first comic was the Magna Carta in Lone Star in 1959. Mm. In the 1960s, he did such stories. And a lot of this stuff you can find on Google, but it's quite a difficult one to sort of printed. Captain Condor for Lion. Planet Zed for Hurricane, Memorable Moments in Sport, Paddy Ryan, The Suicide Six, Jet Ace Logan, all names lost to history, unfortunately, to be fair. And then I found it interesting, I didn't know this till I did some research. In 1966, he moved into animation, did some work on the Yellow Submarine film.
That's right, isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
I never knew that myself until very recently doing the research along with yourself. I'd love to know what elements he did of the Yellow Submarine.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, and I was reading a little thread on a blog about him, and it, as part of the article, it said that he was involved in the Muppet Show,
and somebody, that's right.
Somebody who was, I think, if you sort of scroll down to the comments, someone who was his grandson came on and said he was involved in the Muppet Show, and he also did the Muppet Show Annual one year, which was quite interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a classic jobbing artist, basically.
Yeah.
The artists today, or the ones that came into rose to stardom from 2000 AD onwards, specialized in the sort of strips they wanted to tell. You know, they wanted to do science fiction, and obviously a lot of things like 2000 AD and DC and Vertigo and all the other books that these British artists went on to are still in print and are evergreen in terms of reprints and resales. But Brian, being an artist from the 1950s and 60s, it was seen as very disposable. And as you read off all those titles, not all those, most of those are not in print anymore.
Yeah, they're
very hard to get hold of.
Yeah, you can find the odd sort of page on YouTube, on Google, rather. But I've heard, in the research I've done for this and the last episode, and a couple of episodes actually, you hear a lot of artists will say, you know, they didn't want to admit at dinner parties that they worked in comics. Comics were trash media, you know, to a certain extent. And they would just say, oh, they work in magazines, or they illustrate novels, or, you know, illustrations for novels and stuff like that. They weren't sort of as proud of it as perhaps everyone is now, you know.
Oh, it was completely different now, isn't it? Even when I started out in video games in the 1980s and 90s, it was still, you know, polite to dinner parties. Not that I went to many polite dinner parties, but, you know, if I ever got invited to them and people said, so, well, what do you do then, Jason? It just like, you kind of muttered,
drug dealer.
I work in electronic entertainment or something like that. Games and comics. Yeah, it was the double whammy. It was just wasn't respectable. Like, today, it's just it's a huge industry, isn't it? It makes more money than any other medium in terms of, like, say, movies and music, and it's people, you know, love them. But it was very different. So for poor Brian Lewis, it must have been very difficult.
I'll rattle off a couple more titles so we can talk about them. He did. He worked in Core, which I think a friend of ours, Pat, often describes as the unfunny version of comedy comics for kids, in a strip called Buster. He did Les Dawson comics.
That's right. And they have an interesting kind of Leo Baxendale quality to those strips, I was thinking. A lot of people listening to this will probably come to this podcast of yours, Tony, because of the horror connection with House of Hammer. But Brian Lewis's, you know, very cartoony children's comic strip stuff, it's got that really sort of classical sort of Bruins or Willy sort of, you know, brushwork to the artwork. It's quite incredible how not only prolific, but the different styles, you know, he would use in his work as well, from the sort of grey colour wash stuff from his 1950s, 60s comics to, you know, his strip cartoon stuff to his movie adaptations.
Yeah. And I don't know I can't remember off the top of my head, what was the strip you sent me some pictures of just before we came on?
Oh, that's something that, you know, Brian Lewis mostly worked on other people's materials because he was a jobbing artist, but occasionally he did come up with his own strips, which tended to be rather kind of, you know, quite sexual in terms of, well, not even innuendo, is it?
It was just all out. A little bit more than like it was like a Confessions level of sort of humor.
Yeah, very much so, yes.
Yeah. So there's that. He did Georgie's Genius, I think it was, in Wham. He did Planet Zed in Hurricane. He did an Eagle in 1963. He did Man of Battle. And Home of Warriors, I think it was called. And he did do some stuff for 2000 AD, as I'm right in saying, didn't he?
He worked very briefly on one, I think two episodes, but I'll say one episode of Pat Mills's Dan Dare.
Yes.
Which you can find in the reprints by Rebellion. And I know a lot of well-regarded comic artists today, you know, they look to that strip as being an absolutely beautiful rendition of that era's Dan Dare.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, I think he actually, it's like a fill-in for Gibbons, I think, isn't it?
It's definitely a fill-in episode or two. I think it's one episode. Okay. Yeah, it's gorgeous to look at.
He did Dan Dare's Space Fort, which is a 2000 AD star pin-up, which looks pretty impressive. He did some Captain Scarlet in Countdown, 1971. And he did some work in Chilling Tales of Mystery from Damien Dark in Spellbound in 1976, which I remember, Spellbound, if you do. And then another favourite of ours that we have talked about in the past is he did the Sweeney Annual, 1978.
Again, jobbing artists, he will bounce around from, you know, Dan Dare to the Sweeney to Countdown Comics to Hammer Horror. But he does all of them with such aplomb, like the Sweeney comic strip from the Annual is gorgeous to look at.
It's amazing, yeah.
Especially since he's actually, you know, hand painted it as well, and his colour work is just beautiful as well.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, so we'll get on to what we're going to talk about now. So it's a magazine that predates Warrior magazine. that was created by Deskin in a number of different. I can't. To be fair, I read his blog about it, and I kind of lost track of the places that it was created and the names it was created. But I did note down the three names he had for it. So it was initially House of Hammer. Then it became House of Horror. And this, I don't know, I'm not sure if it's a made-up story, perhaps by Des or by someone, that they were trying to get Warren magazines to distribute in the States. And Warren decided it sounded a little bit like House of Hammer, sounded like a DIY magazine. I was just telling you that a minute ago. I don't know how true that is, but so it's changed to, for whatever reason. It may be a licensing issue, possibly. I know that Des is someone who dealt with a lot of licensed products, you know, Doctor Who, etc. Became a House of Horror, and then became Halls of Horror, eventually. Now, the special we've got is from Brian died in 1970, end of 1978. So this is 4 years after he died. This is the Halls of Horror Winter Special. And it features only strips, pretty much, apart from the odd advert. It's almost completely comics, isn't it? Which is unusual for this magazine. You know.
It is, right. It feels like a tribute, doesn't it? I'm
Yeah.
just reading the introduction on the first page, and it reads, "Representing the fantasy artwork of the late Brian Lewis, a man whose humor and character may have died with him, but whose artistic accomplishments will live forever. This issue is respectfully dedicated to his memory."
There you go. Good stuff. Yeah, quite right too. It's slightly smaller, actually. I don't know if you noticed the size change.
Oh yes,
It's
you're right.
Almost an inch shorter, I would say, in height.
Yeah, I'm just
and
comparing them now.
yeah, which I'm going to say had, for me, had a negative effect on the artwork. I'm not sure if it's the aging of this. Mine's a pretty tatty copy, but the aging of the magazine. But I actually found some of the black to, because he uses white backgrounds for lettering and black backgrounds for lettering, and some of the black background stuff isn't printed particularly well. It's actually not that readable.
Not in this reprint, no, I
Yeah.
agree. Yeah, the black caption panels with the
Yeah.
white text, yeah, it's quite spindly looking, isn't it? It's quite
Yeah.
hard.
Yes, and it's a newsprinty kind of paper, and it's not aged well. It's mine's a quite a browning version, but
Yeah, mine's very yellow and you're browning at the edges.
and we both got excited, and we both bought the Collected Classics, which is
Oh, yes.
a 5-volume collection of all the comic strips from the series that began as the House of Hammer. The lettering in them is actually, because of the paper and the sort of bright whiteness of the paper in some of this, it's actually more readable, I find.
Yeah,
What do you think?
definitely. I was reading them in the Guardian earlier. It's definitely much more readable than the old newspaper prints
Yeah.
editions.
Now, if you look for Des online, there's a couple of sort of videos. I think they tried to make a documentary about him a few years ago, and they put a lot of the sort of little snippets of advice that he has out as like short 1 to 10 minute video clips. And he drinks a lot of red wine in those clips, it has to be said. So, and then there's a couple of them, let's say slightly ranting, but they are good quality to watch. And in one of them, he says, "Never aim for the fans." And
Oh.
he uses the description of Blake Seven. So he says, if you're going to make a magazine for Blake Seven, all two of them will buy it, which is kind of true these days as well. But he says, if you're going to make a magazine that's interesting and good, and it maybe has a competition in or something like that, people buy it, see it's good, and return to it. And I kind of think that's what he was doing with these, because apart from this Winter Special, which is a special edition because it's just comic strips, most of these had book reviews and articles on actresses and actors and films and coming soon and stuff like that, didn't I? Which is why I was drawn to it as a
Yeah, it was
mixture,
like
I
a,
think.
basically the British version of Famous Monsters of Movieland,
Yeah.
in that half of the magazine, I probably want to say, was articles on then contemporary movies and also looking back at Hammer movies with lots of black and white photographs and text reviews or articles or features.
And you've got to remember that we didn't see much. There was no VHSs back then. You know, we didn't really see. All you saw of horror films was sometimes like one still, you know, or
Yes.
even just the cover of something, you know.
Yeah, those black and white, those kind of newsprint black and white photographs were, if you were a youngster getting into horror movies, and you couldn't go to the cinema because they would no longer be shown there, and you had no VHS or the internet or even television would show them seldomly late at night,
Yeah.
quite rarely. The only thing you had was things like these magazines with black grainy black and white photographs
Yeah.
that, you pore over and they kind of they're burnt onto your young
They
impressionable
really are,
mind.
yeah.
It's like,
Yeah.
wow, I want to see that gory, sleazy movie in this magazine.
Exactly. I think I had a book on Dracula movies, and there was just the one panel of countless Dracula getting out of the bath of blood, and it got looked at quite a lot by my young self, I've got to admit to you. So where was your first exposure to this? Let's start with the artist. What was your exposure to? Was it the same as the same time you? So the first time you saw him was this magazine, was it?
It definitely would have been House of Hammer magazine. And it would have been, my parents would go, I think this is probably a very familiar story to a lot of people of a certain age, such as ourselves. When you went on holiday with your parents to the seaside, and in Britain, invariably, it rains a lot during the summer holidays. So you're kicking around the kind of coastal town you happen to be staying in, popping into a newsagent and seeing a lurid, colourful, you know, vampire in a magazine color or a zombie or something like that, and your sort of 8-year-old self would go, whoa, what's that? Get it off the shelf. And in those days, there were no real restrictions on what you could buy as a kid. You know, you could take this horror magazine to the counter and buy and walk out of the shop. Same with pulp novels, sort of Guy and Smith, that kind of stuff, you know, giant crabs. And you read them at home and you find that they're full of, you know, gore and porn and everything else that every young impressionable mind needs.
Yeah.
So it would have been at a coastal resort that I first bought House of Hammer. And what really appealed to me, other than the photograph, the lurid black and white photographs, would have been the comic strip adaptations, because that was basically our version of renting a video film, was reading the comic strip adaptation of a movie that you'd only seen a few black and white photographs of.
Because a lot of these were ex certificate, weren't they? You know, a lot of them were.
Much so, yes.
Yeah.
And proudly displayed as well on the, usually on the first page of these comic adaptations, they'd have Brian Lewis or the other artists, because the other artists that drew for House of Hammer were up and coming British artists like Brian Bolland, John Bolton, and so forth, before
David
they
Lloyd,
moved to 2000 AD. Yeah. So the first page would always be a kind of their version of a splashy mock up of a poster, and they'd have the credits for the actors and the director and so forth, and they'd have the big X certificates drawn onto the page as well.
They did, yeah. That was really weird, wasn't it? I remember looking at it, because you used to looking at the credits and it's saying the name of the artist and the writer, but this just used to say, oh, starring, you know, Valerie Leon or someone like that. You know, it's like that, isn't it?
So it really felt like you were reading a movie.
Yeah, it really did. Michael Carreras, who was the head of Hammer at the time, actually, I think he said, or allegedly said to someone, the strips were better than the movies themselves often.
As much as I love those Hammer movies, I probably have to agree as well.
Because
all the restrictions that you had at the time making those movies, and also the rating system in the UK, meant you could only show so much. So these artists could really go to town on all the gore and splash it about the page a bit more.
And occasionally the acting was a little wooden, as much as I love Captain Kronos as a theory. And, you know, the odd moment in the movie is amazing. The acting could be a bit more on point, couldn't it? Let's face it, yeah.
Absolutely. I think Brian Lewis was a better actor.
I think you're right.
His drawings.
Yeah, you're right. So the other artists involved, I made a note of a couple of them. So you got John Bolton, who's amazing in this. I'd put him up with Brian Lewis's work in this easily, you know. He's got a real Bernie Wrightson feel to some of the pages there as well.
And John Bolton drew the Curse of the Werewolf, was it, Tony? And,
I think you're right.
He 10 million years BC.
1 million years BC, yes. Yeah, which is an amazing film and a movie I watched as a young man and went, oh dear, oh my God, what's that about? You know. And also Paul Neary as well, who doesn't get enough credit as being... his stuff in Eerie Hunter was amazing. I really love Paul Neary's sort of 70s craziness. It was sort of really psychedelic, you know.
He did the adaptation of Moon.
Moon Zero.
Moon Zero One.
All right, okay. Moon Zero One. Lovely, cool. Now, Brian wasn't on board with this from the start. I don't think he started until issue 2, which I think was his cover. But there's a story online, another one that Des tells. He says young Bernard, who was an agent, came to him and said, I've got this artist called Brian Lewis. Did you fancy using him? And he sort of saw Brian as something of an old throwback, you know, like who he knew from stuff like Hurricane and Lion and stuff like that. And he said, well, I don't know. And he showed him some work and he went, no, definitely. Now I need him on board. Which I was pretty impressed with.
Apparently he drew a sort of, which you can find online, a sort of double splash page image of a montage of Hammer movie things. And then sent it to, his agent would have given it to Des, and he was like, oh yeah, we've got to get this guy.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah, that's a really real sort of close-up face, dramatic sort of in dark face. Yeah, really lovely stuff.
Yeah, it's beautiful, make a beautiful poster. And I guess at that point, Brian Lewis would have been in his 40s, whereas Bolland and the other artists were probably in their 20s.
Yeah, no, it's really good. Now, we're playing it like it's all movie adaptions, but it wasn't all movie adaptions. I've got a little rundown of what was in this special by Brian. So you've got a sort of really lovely, if you open the front cover, the facing page is a sort of classic monsters, a sort of pin-up of Dracula and Frankenstein and
It looks very much like a homage, or at least inspired by the Dennis Gifford books of the 70s, Pictorial Guide to Horror, which was my first horror book. And that definitely has that kind of styling to it. The beautiful painted cover for the Pictorial Guide to Horror. Look it up on the Google. It's a great cover.
Yeah, it really is nice. And then you've got the first thing in there is so they had a kind of like the Crypt Keeper, like a Thargs kind of character who would turn up. I seriously don't know whether Des got Peter Cushing's permission. Do you? I haven't read anything about it.
Well, he worked very closely with Hammer, the head of Hammer at the time. Yeah. Allowed them access to the Hammer vaults. So whether or not Peter Cushing got any residuals from his image being used, maybe Hammer owned his image, and Des could freely do what he wants with it. Yeah, but Peter Cushing is the crypt keeper, essentially, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, there's that famous Morecambe and Wise sketch, isn't he? He came back. Did Peter Cushing come back almost every 5 years onto Morecambe and Wise and kept asking them for his pay? Do you remember?
There's a rumour he didn't get paid for the first time. So
So there's something called Van Helsing's Terror Tales is what we're talking about there, and there's a sort of Roman story in that Highway Tale, which I had a look at and really, really enjoyed. I have to say, the reproduction of it, it does not do this magazine, it does not do this art credit. I've got to be honest with you. I think it's muddied and not clear enough, and it could be another third as large to get the full effect.
Yes, in this old 1982.
It looks really nice in the reprints that we bought recently, the stuff that Des has released, I have to say.
Yeah, there's a number of reprints of, I think the volumes of four comic adaptations per volume, and there's four or five volumes in total, but there was also a reprint in another book of the Van Helsing Terror Tales as its own book.
Ah, okay, right,
Which I haven't bought.
And I need to get that.
Of the Hammer.
Yeah, this is, which is a sort of, it's just a three-pager. It ends badly for one of the Centurions. Centurion? It ends badly for him, and you get the sort of smug Peter Cushing talking to the camera at the end, explaining why. It's just nice, it's good, typical of creepy and eerie kind of storytelling, isn't it, really? You know?
Yeah, and there's one thing I know we've discussed in private, is obviously the fashion for today's comics is very decompressed storytelling.
Yeah.
Whereas in a lot of these Hammer adaptations or these Van Helsing Terror Tales or just the comics of that era, is it's very compressed storytelling.
Yeah.
So in three pages, you can introduce characters, world build, have a three-act structure in three pages.
Yeah.
But they were the masters of really economic storytelling, the writers and comic artists of the 1960s and 70s. It's one thing I really appreciate, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, is just the panel structure of Brian Lewis's pages.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the mirror one that's coming up. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
The Steve Parkhouse wrote this, who obviously Des would go to work on was around this time working with him on Warrior magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Steve's great. Love his stuff. That's good. So that's a quick three pages. Then we get a typical Des House of Horror collector's item back issue page, which you always got in these. Which I used to sort of think, oh, I haven't got that one. What's that one about? You know.
Yeah, and in those days, you couldn't go online and buy them. I rarely posted away for comics or books because I was only 8 or 9 years old at the time.
Yeah.
So you would have to look at those. You look at those back issues and go, oh my god, look at that one! It's got Curse of the Werewolf in it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you were the same, Tony, but I would have to go to the town centre where I lived and go to like secondhand bookstalls that also would have secondhand magazines and papers, and you'd have to go through.
You'd have to be lucky.
Thumbing through the kind of equivalent of long boxes, which would be actually on a market stall bench, and go through all the old magazines and try and pluck out, look for that logo, the Hammer logo, and pull it out and buy it secondhand, and it might be a bit tatty, but that was the only way you could get hold of these things back then.
Yeah, which was kind of a little hunt for us, wasn't it? A treasure hunt for us. I kind of liked
absolutely.
Really.
Yeah, it was great. It just made it, every time you got one, you treasured you treasured that magazine because you didn't know whether or not you'd find another one.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I'm going to quickly talk a little bit, and we're about to talk about Legend of the Golden Seven Golden Vampires, which is the movie we also both watched the other day to catch up ready for this. But it's written by Steve Moore. Steve Moore is kind of a bit of a, I don't know, a bit of a legendary figure in British comics, isn't he, really? He's
lot of people would know him from working with Pat Mills in the Doctor Who weekly comic.
Ah, okay, yeah.
A lot of the sticks were Pat Mills and Steve Moore.
Yeah, okay, I was thinking more that he's known for working... He's considered to be something of a mentor to Alan Moore, no relation. Mm-hmm. And they would work together in Sounds magazine. And I think Steve Moore wrote under Pedro Henry, and Alan Moore wrote under Kurt Vile. But it's where they created Axel Pressbun,
right?
Who later appeared in Warrior and Eclipse magazines. But why didn't really? I don't know why I didn't know this. But Steve Moore was also the editor of 14 Times for years.
I never knew that.
No, I didn't either. That's cool, isn't it? Yeah, he also wrote a novelization of V for Vendetta, which I never knew about either. Yeah. Yeah, you're right though. Created Absalom Dark with Steve Dillon. That would have been in Doctor Who Weekly, Doctor Who Monthly at the time. He did some Nick Fury and Hulk for Marvel UK. Did some Future Shocks, Tales of Tel Guth, which I know came out as a trade about 6 years ago. I'm going to say, and worked extensively in Warrior. Did Zerk, Jeremy Sheila's. So Zerk was kind of a spin-off of Axel Pressbun, Laser Eraser, and he did Father Shandor. Now Father Shandor was a story that was in the Hammer comic and moved over. So was it Father Shandor? Was it Demon Hunter or Devil Hunter? I can never remember. But he moved over, which was a John Bolton drawn strip, which is amazing, absolutely amazing.
Yeah, that's great.
So he was on board to write this story, which he does well. Having watched the movie as you did, he fits pretty much the whole movie into a very short number of pages, but also allows the odd splash for Brian to work on as well. There's some choreographed kung fu. There's two of them in this, I think, that are sort of perfectly choreographed and just show a fight, you know.
It's about around 15 pages in total, isn't it?
The entire,
taking a 90 or 100 minute movie and turning it into 15 pages as again is just a wonderful exercise in economic, very compressed storytelling, but just such an amazing use of panels. And I don't know who mapped these panels out. I'd love to see one of Steve Moore's scripts
for these,
just to see how they were interpreted by Brian when he was drawing them.
Yeah, because there's a prologue to this movie. It's got a funny structure to it, actually. There's a prologue to it where this character sort of arrives at Dracula's castle, and then Dracula, who's not looking too well, takes over his body and then becomes this Chinese character who sort of obviously just schleps it back to China after that. And it's got, I'm just counting now, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. It's got 13 panels on that page.
Yeah, tiny little panels, but your eye is drawn around them all. It's constructed so beautifully, the prologue page, page 8, isn't it?
Yeah.
And again, when I read these things as a child, I would like savor each panel. My eyes would run over the panels and almost like will them into motion. And the way Brian has drawn, say, the first four panels, where you have it's a wide shot, but he's drawn it vertically of Dracula's castle. And as your eyes run down the castle, you see the little figure of the Chinese character walking towards the castle. And then you've got the art, Brian Lewis, word Steve Moore credits.
Yeah.
And then as your eyes run up to the top of the page, there's three panels drawn showing the movement of time of this Chinese monk walking down the kind of Gothic staircase with the text overlaid onto it.
Yeah.
A modern comic would take, that would be an entire, that would be two pages, because the castle would be the first page would be a big splash page of the castle. And then the next page would probably be the monk walking down the stairs.
It would be. And it's, you've got the entire confrontation and everything that happens in that one page. He bites him, he becomes him, you know, it's,
Yeah, then you got your setup all in one page.
Yeah. I know this is something you've said to me before when we talked about him, because I know you're a big fan of his work, and I've probably, to be fair, only really paid more attention to him because you told me he's so good. And all right, obviously. But is the way he captures people's faces without being that kind of photorealistic tracing thing that you get.
That's another thing I really admire about Brian Lewis. I mean, he would have made these comics, I think, in sort of 1976, 77 when he was drawing them. And he would not have had access to a DVD player pausing, pausing the screen and tracing frames from the movie. He probably would have had a handful of publicity photographs. He would have had the actors' likenesses in a photograph, and he might have even gone to see the movies. Maybe Hammer showed them in Soho Square, where the Hammer office used to be, possibly. I don't know. But either way, he wouldn't have had that much reference material than a few photographs. So he would have had to sort of, to want of an expression, sort of wing the environments and the costumes. And whereas today, you see it in comics, when it's like, I don't know, it's a licensed comic based on a TV property or a movie. You can see the artists have copied publicity photos and so forth.
It's
And
the
you do
same
what you do.
image keeps appearing, the same
Yeah, you do
angle of
what
the
you do
face keeps
to
appearing,
hit your
isn't it?
deadlines, because it's a really hard job drawing a monthly comic in 22 pages, so you take the shortcuts. But Brian Lewis, an artist of his ilk, wouldn't have had those shortcuts. So he's really gone to town on the characters' faces, and he's interpreted the actors' likenesses in his own style. And I think he's just a master of drawing, human figures. They've got a real solidity and a weight to them. Like they feel to me like they have gravity. They feel kind of really anchored into the frames that I really admire about Brian's artwork.
Yeah, I agree. There's some amazing pages. There's some pages here that it just occurs to me. Page 9 and page 15
Oh, yeah.
could be a Shaw Brothers movie poster, with some color added,
Yeah,
Damien said.
and so the readers know page 9 is basically a big splash page proclaiming the title, The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, Certificate X. I'm sure Des was aware that he was, a lot of kids would be buying this magazine who couldn't see these movies. So you want to really enforce the
So
fact
push
that this
that
is like,
X.
this is something, forbidden fruit you've got in your hands here, kids. But it's a big splash page of the seven vampires themselves on horseback, riding from a Chinese traditional looking temple, with the credits: Peter Cushion, Julie Edge, I'm not sure his name, and David Chiang. So you got the credits for the actors. And then when you cut to page 15, it's a great splash page of a martial arts, a very gory martial arts fight, which again works in the kind of like circular motion. So if you run your eyes around it, the characters, you see them moving in a sort of circle. With
Because
the female Chinese warrior slaying two men at the same time, and an archer firing his bow at the General Wang, General Yang,
That's
through
my
his neck,
internet
killing. And it's
name.
just a beautiful, like I said, it's like a poster art.
Yeah, it really is. And that fight scene is on page 15 is one of my favorite moments in the movie, actually. And as I understand it, that's one of the moments that was substantially shortened for the American release. That
Apparently,
was
they cut out a lot of the kung fu scenes in the American, or the hand fighting.
So he would have seen the lengthier one, which is, I think, 110 minutes off the top of my head. Is
That's
that
right, yes.
which is quite long for a Hammer movie, actually. I know, bear in mind, we sat through a Hammer movie at a recent film festival, and by the life of me, would say it was probably shorter than that, although it did seem to go quite quickly.
It did feel shorter.
So for those that have never seen Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, it was filmed in 1974 at the Shaw Brothers Studio, in the most part. Had fighting scenes, as we said, added for the Eastern release by a second director, a guy called Chang Che, who also directed The One-Armed Swordsman and Five Venoms. For those with Netflix, Five Venoms is on Netflix if you want to go and see it. So that's pretty
Absolutely
impressive.
worth watching.
Definitely. He also did The Water Margin, which is a great little series that I haven't
Oh,
rewatched for
that's
years.
great. That was repeated on, was it Channel 4 or
I think you're
BBC?
right. Yeah, I think you're
The
right.
1980s.
The English director of it was Roy Ward Baker, who, just do yourself a favour and look up his photograph on Wikipedia, and it just says everything about him. He was actually the assistant director on Hitchcock's The Lady Vanishes, which I found quite interesting. Did a lot of TV work, of series that you and I will both love. So he did The Avengers, he did The Saint, he did The Persuaders, he did The Champions, if you remember that. And he even did your favourite TV series, Minder. I know that you're a big fan of.
Again, though, like comic artists of that era, Brian Lewis and so forth, they were jobbing creatives, jumping from project to project.
Yeah, he was kind of well known for doing horror stuff. So he did Quatermass in the Pit, which I think to me is almost my favourite Hammer film. I know it's a bit of a sacrilege to say, but I really love that film.
It's, I would probably say it's their most critically well-regarded movie.
You might be right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Vampire Lovers, which I really must watch again. He worked for Amicus. He did Asylum with them. He did The Monster Club. And now the screaming starts. And he did another much reviled, but actually not too bad film, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde.
Oh, I love Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde. We met the actress, didn't we, recently in London?
Of course we did. Yeah, of course we did. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah. Well, do you remember one of the ladies there was that actress from Cat's Eyes? Do you remember
that's right.
And the writer of this, Don Houghton, of Legend 7, he wrote a load of Cat's Eyes episodes as well, believe it or not. A couple of other little interesting facts. We're not a film podcast, but I thought it might be. It's an adaptation of films talk.
So they're closely meshed, aren't they, for this particular podcast?
Definitely. So Julie Edge, who plays Vanessa Buren in this movie, was also Miss Dazzle in The Final Programme, the Jerry Cornelius movie, which is a great movie. You can look that one out. That's a proper nuts movie. You've seen that, have you?
I have, yes.
Yeah.
I never knew how to pronounce the names. I'm glad you've cleared that up.
David Chiang was also something of a Hong Kong superstar, who's the main sort of the... He's kind of the love interest almost, isn't he? He's kind of...
Yeah, which is quite quite progressive for the era.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I mean, another thing we should also mention, Tony, is this being a co-production between Hammer and Shaw Brothers. Both Hammer and Shaw Brothers were, especially Hammer, were in somewhat of a decline because of competition from independent cinema in America for Hammer, with things like Night of the Living Dead and Rosemary's Baby and so forth. And the gothic tropes of Hammer were becoming old hat. And the Shaw Brothers, Tony and I, by the way, are very much into martial art movies, so it's another pleasures in life. Is that the Shaw Brothers were also in competition with Golden Harvest at the time, who had Bruce Lee, and people like Jackie Chan were up and coming and moving into Golden Harvest. So both studios were, we need to work together and somehow try to reclaim some of our territory, our patch. And hence, this film was born.
As I understand it, it was something of a financial failure at the
time.
That's
right.
Well.
So I believe it. Yes.
Yeah, and there was I found somewhere on the internet that said that they were looking to make a sequel called in India called Carly Devil Bride of Dracula.
That's right, yes.
I'd have watched the shit out of that, I've got to tell you.
Yeah. It's like they're moving from China to India, what next?
Yeah. Written by Don Houghton. He wrote Doctor Who's Inferno and Mind of Evil for John Pertwee. He wrote probably also one of my favourite films from Hammer, which was Dracula 1972, which is a genius bit of making, if you ask me. The Satanic Rites of Dracula, another favourite of ours.
Yeah.
And he wrote Sapphire and Steel as well, believe it.
Oh,
some episodes of that.
Now,
here's a little gem. He was married to Rick Sen Lim, who was the Chinese actress in Mind Your Language.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Yeah, how strange is that? Yeah, the world, world occasionally collides.
This is carries through into the movie, doesn't it, in some ways?
And the second episode in a row, we've mentioned Mind Your Language. How is that?
Tony, one thing I was fascinated by, if you wanted to do a sequel to Legends of Golden Vampires, I quite was interested in the fact that Van Helsing's son, who's in this movie as well, hooks up with the female Chinese fighter.
Yes.
And I couldn't help but think, wow, maybe they did get together and they had a child who would be,
that'd be brilliant.
Half Caucasian and half Chinese, who might go on to, again, fight vampires in future episodes, carrying the kind of Van Helsing and her kind of spiritual Chinese family's name into the future. You could have Mr. Vampire and all that kind of stuff in there.
Because she's proper kick-ass in this film.
Oh, she's amazing. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, really good. Yeah, that's copyright, by the way. We've copyrighted that.
It's our next project.
And those that don't know Shaw Brothers, they made hundreds of movies. They made everything. Everyone thinks of them as a sort of martial arts movie studio, which they were to a big extent. But they also did stuff like slightly erotic movies.
Mm-hmm.
They did sort of kitchen sink stuff, some historical settings. And I read today, now you'll know better than me, much more about movies than me, but apparently they invested in Blade Runner.
That's right, Sir Run Run Shaw, who was one of the two Shaw brothers, invested into another famous flop at the time.
Yeah, that's true. There you go.
Yeah,
there was
three
brothers, weren't there?
In the titles for the movie.
Ah, okay. So it's Run Run Shaw, Run Me Shaw, and Runned Shaw.
That's right.
Their mum didn't have much imagination, did she, with first names? So I've got to be honest with you.
And also, Run Run Shaw the Shaw Brothers and Hammer Studios all had arrangements with Warner Brothers, with and Warner Brothers
Right.
being a bankrolled, percent partially bankrolled Blade Runner.
Ah, okay. I get you. Nice. Cool. So that's the Marshall Legend of Seven Golden Vampires movie adaptation, which is the for me almost the it's the high point of the two sort of longer form ones. It's I'm glad I've got that reprint of it because it's so much easier to read. This is far too muddied, and the printing process didn't do Brian
Yeah,
any favors in
newsprint is
this.
not the nicest thing to
Yeah,
engage with.
but it's a lovely feeling magazine. This the next thing I wanted to mention was that you then get a page of adverts, which I used to love. I love seeing these adverts because it's got adverts for four. It's page split into four. So you've got The Edge of Forever, Kent's leading stockist of science fiction, horror, and fantasy. You got Forever People, Park Street, Bristol, comic shop and science fiction bookshop. You got Fantasy and Comics Explosion in Birmingham, Summer Row, Birmingham, and you got the Comic Book Shop, Ilkeston Road, Nottingham. All of which I don't think are with us anymore. I think they're all gone.
I suspect so.
But those sort of iconic adverts, you used to see them all over the place in stuff like Fantasy Advertiser and Warrior Magazine and this book and all this sort of thing. And I just love seeing that. I just love seeing those sort of adverts. Yeah, really good.
Well, they're great time capsules, aren't they, for the
Yeah.
industry at the time and just what was the culture that was going on around comics,
Yeah.
these shops or mail
And I
order.
used to dream of going to them. I used to see these adverts. I don't know about you. I used to dream of them and think, oh, I wish one day I could go to that bookshop and buy loads of stuff. And, there was sort of,
Yeah,
yeah,
well, in my
brilliant.
hometown there wasn't a comic shop. I
Right.
grew up in for my sins in Doncaster, and we barely had a bookshop, never mind a comic shop. So my books and comics were bought from secondhand, the secondhand market stalls.
Yeah.
So you end up you couldn't have a subscription. You end up missing lots of issues, and you got random issues. If I wanted to buy a Marvel comic, I'd have a random issue of Spider-Man or whatever, or a
Yeah.
random issue of Hammer House of Horror.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Yes. And so quick, we're not going to describe every single page of this comic, but there's a couple of other bits we're going to definitely talk about. So I want to talk.
Malvoisin's mirror, however you pronounce that, is
Yes.
definitely worth lingering over some of these panels because it's absolutely
Really is, isn't
beautiful.
it? So, which is another Van Helsing terror tale. It reminds me of one of those portmanteau horror films you used to get from Amicus, and I think you got a couple from Hammer and a couple of other companies
Yeah,
at
it's
one
like something
stage of
straight
time.
from Asylum,
Yes, that's the one I
movie
was thinking
from
of.
Amicus.
Yeah. It was written by Chris Lauder, who was assistant editor of IPC's Thunder back in the day, and the creator of a comic character who, which is a bit of a deep cut, but Adam Eterno, if you've heard of him. He worked on Kids Are All Okay for Battle, took over from Pat Mills on it,
Oh, yeah.
Blackjack for Action, Timequake and Roadbusters for Star-Lord, he did a couple of things for Victor Drago for Tornado. He was at the 40th anniversary. I didn't see him there myself, but he's very much described. I spoke to someone who worked in 2000 AD, and they were saying he was very much the guy everyone thought was going to be amazing, but didn't actually get that much work. Now, quite an accomplished writer, and this I think this is a good example of that actually.
Yeah, it's really yes, it's really evocative of like I said, those portmanteau horror movies. And again, it's another. I'd love to see the original script for this one. I don't know,
Yeah.
if Deskin still has them or not. But I just would love to know how it's described, how much detail
Yeah.
goes into the panel, because the panel structure in this strip, and it's something I swiped a little bit, I will admit, for a book that called Surface Tension.
Yeah,
Certainly influenced
love
by
that
some of
book.
these pages. And, Brian Lewis is obviously way above my pay grade. But it's just, yeah, the panels, I'll describe it to the listener.
Yeah.
It's an old chap in a raincoat who's seen an antique mirror. In an antique shop, and this mirror is carved with all these kind of ornate naked women all draped around this mirror, and it has some obviously some kind of like magical properties. And this guy goes into the shop and wants it, but the guy says, "Not for sale! It's not for sale!" So he
Yeah.
kills him to take the mirror, and he looks into the mirror, and I'll let you finish, Tony. But
Yeah, well,
the drawings of the mirror is just amazing.
incredible. Just quickly, the little so always in these Van Helsing terror tales, you get a top left introduction from Peter Cushing, and this is how class this is. It's not just like, oh, let's just get him talking to the reader. In this one, he's actually looking into a mirror to talk to the reader, so you're getting the reflection of Cushing talking to you. Just little touches like that, like little ideas that seem so simple to us now, but people, you know, that the what these people were writing was in such detail, and they got it completely. And I think with this strip is it does completely and utterly throw you into that mood of a horror film. He's clearly guilty as a character to start with, because he's got, it's the cliche shortcut to him being a, you know, a dirty macked pervert, isn't
exactly.
it, basically. Yeah.
Again, it's that really shorthand, compressed storytelling of okay, I've got to get this character across in one panel, you know, and the way Brian's drawn this guy, as you just said, and again, a dirty Mac, is a bit overweight. He's wearing a hat, so he's a bit shady.
People wear bow ties.
You don't need to anymore, do you? Yeah. It's like that.
No, exactly. You've never worn a bow tie. I'm willing to bet you've never worn it.
He's a little bit with his bow tie and everything. Is a little bit I forgot the actor's name now.
Who's Monty from Withnail? Who's Monty from Withnail? He reminds me. There's an element of that to me. You know,
yeah, that's Monty. True. Yeah, Uncle Monty.
Yeah. So he looks into this mirror, and we get the third page in it, which is page 26 in this magazine, is almost totally wordless.
Mm-hmm.
And is a descent through the mirror and into madness, and it's also an exploration of this character's nightmares, but also it's his lusts that become nightmares. So the face of the woman turns out to be the vampire. There's a sort of a sort of globulous mess that is a representation of something. There's the ape creature. There's the murder, there's him, and he's just confused and lost and falling through this mirror, and
he's tumbling through the page, isn't he? It's so great, and your eye is drawn with him as he tumbles, and you see all the other images around him.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. I mean, I'd love to see the original page for this. It's got such an incredible line on it. It really has, isn't it? You know, that's
another thing,
that's
Tony,
probably my standout
I might want
page.
To just interject here. A lot of modern comics are drawn in mind for things like Comixology with the the page moving, the swipe left to move the panels, and a lot of artists now draw in kind of cinematic widescreen panels, whereas Brian Lewis is you know, details are popping out from panels, there's overlays, this thing's moving through panels that you just don't see in a lot of comics today, and that would just be a nightmare for something.
Yeah,
like
this would give the person who does the guided view at Comixology give him a headache in the afternoon when it's sometime. Because you're actually reading from the top left of the page to the bottom right of the page, but you're not zigzagging across. There's actually a falling personality. The main fat character falls down through the page, and he's being attacked on left either side and by creatures and dead people. And
it's almost animated, isn't it? Maybe this is why for a while he moved into animation. Maybe this is some of his animation training he might have had, because just the way the characters move through the pages and panels, they look. They're very consistent in the proportions and the character, and they look like animations from a flip book.
Yeah, they really do. And he's throwing a lot of designs at that page, isn't he? There's a lot of design work going into each of the characters. There's an intuitive nature to the way he does this, I think. There's not every line joins up. There's like quite sort of substantial large parts of white space on this page that aren't drawn into.
Yeah, I don't know if we mentioned this or not to the listeners, but Brian Lewis's artwork in his Hammer magazines is exclusively black and white. He did do colour covers for the Hammer magazines, but the actual strip is black and white. And that's one thing that I do miss about black and white comics, is the fact that you can use negative space, which is very hard to do in colour. So you can have things popping out of panels, and you don't have all the messy complications of colouring those elements. So he'll miss lines out. A character will have areas where he's not defined and will just bleed into the whiteness of the page. And it really helps to kind of focus the eye on details, where a lot of artists, you know, to a certain extent can be guilty of hiding behind colour sometimes.
Yeah, no, very
completely. To render the page in 3D, whereas these you know, black and white artists could beautifully render black and white to give things depth and where to focus the eye. The use of line, not every line is filled in. There'll be gaps here and there. Very good point to make, Tony.
Yeah, no, I do love that page. It is amazing. And it pulls out to have the last page. It's got some really great facial acting on it. You've got various bits of surprise, scared, smug, being strangled. You know, there's like caught off guard. He acts so well on this page. Just answering the door to the cleaner one.
There's fear. There's terror, strangulation, glee. Yeah. Happiness. Yeah. It's a great range of emotions that character has on one single page.
So well done. Good. We're going to touch on a couple of, because I know we're almost at an hour now. We're going to touch on a couple more strips I know that we've talked about before and we want to mention. Then I think it would be wrong of us not to mention his covers as part of it, I think. The next one is a strip that you told me just before we came online called Space Burst, which came from Starburst magazine.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. One of the few ones that's written by Brian as well. It's a one-pager.
Again, I think when Brian was writing his own strips, which he didn't do too much of, but there's definitely a cheeky British comedy smut element to a lot of his own work.
There's a sauciness to it. There's a carry-on-ness to him.
I think
there's
a bit of Tony Esmond in there.
I would love to have written this story, I have to say. So it's a story about a spaceman spacewalking, and I remember reading it and thinking, Is that a fart noise? Does he keep doing a fart noise? And it's basically about someone who's sort of walking across the top of a spaceship in his spacesuit, trying to get to the airlock before he shits his pants.
That's it.
That's it. But it's done so well.
And again, it's one page.
And it's got 15, 16 panels in it.
Yes.
But it's just genius, absolute genius. And like, again, there's the look of desperation and this, when he farts and he links, there's something, you know, something's come out there. You know, you can tell on his face.
It's just a great look of relief, isn't it, as he's doing his business in the final panel. And also, because there's no gravity, because it's an astronaut, Ryan has he's played around with the panel structure and you know, the left and right up-downness of the situation. So the final panel where he is taking his dump in his astronaut suit, it's drawn with him standing on the page margin away from the centerfolds because he's in zero G. This is great. It's really good.
Really good. I actually think that his artwork is slightly different for the rest of the issue. I think there's a difference between his Space Burst stuff and even his Malvosian's Mirror, what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
When you see the lair of the dragon, it's slightly heavier inked. It's slightly more less surrealistic, maybe.
I think he's changing his style depending on the tone of the story he's telling, which is a great skill for an artist to have, to go from really heavy, sort of sinister, you know, gothic overtones, such as you know, something like his Reptile Strip, which is not in this magazine, or Lair of the Dragon, for example. And then his Malvonian's Mirror and Space Burster, they're a little bit more, I don't know, cartoony in tone, a bit more cheeky. Certainly Space Burst.
Less heavily inked, maybe?
Yeah, definitely. And just his facial renderings are more, there's more a slight cartoony edge to them as well. Which again comes from his, you know, his work doing those kind of like core comic strips and, you know, sort of family entertainment strips. And cheeky sex satires.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So we get a series. We get another Van Helsing Terror Tales, and then we get the Quatermass Experiment, which is the other big adaptation in this comic. I found a strange choice for the special, actually. Maybe it was whatever he had nearby, Des, you know, whatever was the best quality to put into this magazine. But there's a couple of, you know, I maybe would have put the Reptile in before this. I think this is a slightly slower, more sedate. And we were talking about the film before we came on, and it's something I sort of started watching the other day. But it's about a man who turns into...
A vegetable.
Yes.
it's like basically Doctor Who ripped it off, didn't they, for the Seeds of Doom.
Yeah, it's got that sort of man turns into vegetable kind of storyline, which is always frightening, you know.
But the film itself is okay. I mean, obviously it was groundbreaking in terms of it set the template for those kind of stories of an astronaut returning from outer space infected by something that's possessed him and is changing his flesh. I mean, I think Nigel Neal, who wrote the original TV show, you know, nobody had done that before, as far as I'm aware, and it's being copied and it's mutated over the decades into things like, you know, Species.
Things. Yeah.
But the actual TV show and the film itself is very thinly plotted. But what I really like about Brian Lewis's adaptation, certainly in terms of art, I don't know if it was in the original script, but he's really gone to town with the transformation of the astronaut, which you don't get in the Hammer version. The Hammer version, he's got a bit of a kind of like manky distorted arm, but you don't see him go through these gruesome, you know, changes that would have meant for, you know, a very big budgets, which obviously Hammer never had at the time. And this is more like a, Brian Lewis has gone for kind of David Cronenberg's The Fly sort of transformation of the astronaut, which is depicted in the comic itself.
Which in the second to last page just goes haywire and is almost back to what I was used to with him for those previous tricks we were talking about. There's a really complicated. I mean, if someone says draw a mutant plant, he's drawn a mutant plant times 23 on
Oh
that page,
yes,
isn't he? Yeah, it's
yeah.
amazing.
It's just like a great splash of just weird alien vegetation spread over Saint. Is it Saint Paul's Cathedral or
Oh, is that where it is?
Westminster
Okay.
Abbey, isn't it? Yeah,
Okay.
Westminster Abbey. Yeah, it's great. I
Right, and
mean,
it's
there's some great panel layouts
Yeah.
in this strip. Again, I really like the mutation scenes.
Yeah. And this is an early Hammer, isn't it? It's from it's almost around the time of the Abominable Snowman kind
Yes.
of period, isn't it? So it's before the sauciness had really sort of come out,
Yeah,
A lot of
definitely.
people
When
see
Hammer
Hammer as
was probably going for slightly more, sort of highbrow sci-fi than the,
Yeah, which was what
nudie gore.
I mean that was the popular thing at the time, wasn't it? The sci-fi radio shows and stuff like that
Yes.
was very popular at the time. So that's great, and that is amazing. And there's one other Van Helsing Territorial called The Curse of Cormac in this magazine. And then we get an advert for movie poster mags, which I know Des used to sell at the time. The classic movies of the time. So you had the Heavy Metal movie. Have you ever seen that, by the way?
Oh
The
yes,
Heavy Metal
I
movie.
have definitely seen that.
Some Kung Fu posters, Mummy Dearest, if you remember that, the Doc Savage movie poster magazine,
I
the Legend of the Lone Ranger.
that
How's
was
a
obviously
seen
TV
that for many
episodes.
years?
Must have been edited into a movie,
Must be, yeah.
possibly.
The Popeye movie, For Your Eyes Only, one of the greatest Bonds, and then Shogun, which was an amazing TV series. I loved
Oh
that.
yeah, that was great. James Clavell's Shogun.
We all thought we spoke Japanese, didn't we? Because we learned about three phrases from that back in school.
Yeah, to be honest, that was my introduction to sort of Japanese culture.
I think me too.
Yeah, before I
Yeah, I
started
think
moving on
me
to
too.
Japanese movies like Kurosawa and so on.
Yeah, now we're like addicted. Yeah,
That's
that's the
it.
reason. Yeah.
Also, Tony, I'd like to
And
say on the last page of the actual strip of
Yeah.
Curse of Cormac, the one thing I really liked as a kid, and I was quite weirdly obsessed by and scared of at the same time, was the gore on the pages.
Right.
So the final panel of this magazine, The Curse of
Yeah.
Cormac, is a guy with his eyeballs gouged out
Oh yeah.
and with his tongue sticking out, and it's just a really horrible image. Say I
Yeah,
was
the two
only
cops
maybe
trying to not
8 years
throw
old at the
up. Yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Lots of gore in these comics that were not in the Hammer movies.
And easily the quality could be in Creepy and Eerie or Vampirella as well, easily that
Yes.
quality.
Well, he did draw
And
one strip for Vampirella.
he did. Yeah.
Yes.
It was described by someone, I haven't dug it out yet. I've got the hardback of it, but described it as being far too crammed in for what they required.
I can imagine some people being, editors possibly being quite resistant of that kind of styling, because it certainly is, the panels are really, bunched together. It's something if you
Yeah.
reproduce this in, like one thing I don't like about a lot of modern reprints today, naming no names, but they'll shrink down the formats.
Yes.
So,
Yep.
these were drawn to be a larger, certainly much bigger than US size pages, sort of 2 size in the old days if people are familiar with that. So you could fit a lot more panels onto a page. But once you shrink
Yeah,
them down
traditionally
to
that's what English comics were from Eagle onwards, really. That was what we did, wasn't it?
yeah, very, I mean, Eagle was like a broadsheet, wasn't it, in terms of size? A really big thing. So yeah, we squash all that down, it starts getting very too fiddly and complicated.
The other one was on the back page, as I just wanted to mention, was Quality Comics, which was South London's top fancy bookshop, 3 Lewisham Way. Did you ever pop in there?
No, because unfortunately I would have been, because I only moved down south in 1995,
Right, it had
and I
gone
did go
gone
to
in, hadn't
London a
it?
lot, but I don't remember that.
Yeah, this was in scary South London, so I was working about 2 miles from this place, and my bus home would go past. And back then, you didn't realise where comic shops were because there was no internet. And I remember from the top deck of the bus going, "Is that Axel press button?" Because they had an Axel press button up against the window on the top floor or on the first floor or something, and getting out. And it was Des Skin in his shop.
Wow. Are you I mean, have you met
A
Deskin?
few times, yeah. I bought some stuff off him from eBay, and he says, "Oh, why don't you come and collect it?" And I drove down to his house in Brighton and had let's call it far too much to be able to drive home afternoon with him.
Now, the one thing I
He
would have asked him, because obviously being a huge fan of these Brian Lewis strips, is Does he have any of the original art still?
That's what I'm interested in. I think, because if you buy anything off eBay, anything kind of to do with these magazines, they tend to come from Des.
They do, yes.
He's got a big eBay store. And I'd love to know that. I really would. I don't know.
I picture him in his house, just surrounded by piles of quality comics publications that he flogs on eBay now and again to top his pension up.
He's got a big corner house. It's like a, I think I'd had quite a lot of wine at this point, but I think he keeps it in the basement, I think is what he told me.
Oh, right.
But I mean, there's a lot of stuff we wouldn't have in comics these days if it wasn't for Des. I know he takes the hits occasionally, but
yeah, again, just to reinforce it, like the House of Hammer Comics was one of the first places where a lot of these now sort of within the industry household comic names like Bolland and John Bolton.
Yeah, David Lloyd.
Yeah, exactly. David Lloyd, and who did the second Quatermass strip.
A lot of them,
and Alan Moore doing Viva Vendetta in one of Des's publications.
Yeah, in Warrior. That sort of thing. Yeah. Should we mention quickly the covers, and then I know I've got a couple of final questions for you. One of which we talked about.
The covers are absolutely beautiful. I would own. I'd love to own posters of each of these covers and frame them.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'd really do like the one we've talked about, the Seven Golden Vampires.
Gorgeous cover.
I remember seeing that as a kid and thinking, and it actually fucking frightening me, thinking, what on earth is that craziness?
Yes.
You know, I think the thing about Hammer movies where they were hugely intriguing to us as kids, and then you sat down and watched them and you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Let's be frank.
Like lured in. Yeah, lured in by being lots of boobs in them.
I mean, they were very difficult. Really there was, like, all the, you know, I was a big prolific buyer of pulp fiction back in the day. And the covers, well, same for in terms of the early VHS video days, the covers often, the painted lurid covers were obviously often sometimes better than the actual content on the tapes or in the novels.
Yeah. You're right, they were, weren't they? But these, they were kind of ripped, but they were just very well designed and painted covers that were reasonably well represented inside, I think, in a lot of
I think, unlike, a lot of my casual comic friends say, oh, the comic looked, the cover looked amazing, but when I opened the comic, I mean, it's this terrible thing to say, but the art wasn't as good as the cover. But I do think, even though, obviously, the covers of these Hammer magazines were painted, Brian would paint these beautifully coloured covers, the interiors are black and white, but they were still beautiful black and white, interiors.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. They were, and they were like the movie, like with that quote we had earlier from the bloke who ran Hammer. They were almost better than the movie because they were so well drawn and they were so recognisable as the actors in the movies. You see Peter Cushing,
more explicit versions than the films that you watched on screen that would take 90-100 minutes to watch, waiting for that 5 minute of content that you really wanted to see. Whereas you could devour these strips in 15 pages in 5 minutes and get get that nourishment that you're craving.
Yeah. And you'd have a big sweeping view of a castle with crows flying over the top of it. And in the actual movie, you'd just have someone knocking at a door.
Rubber bat flapping around on a piece of string.
Yeah. There's some rubber bats in that, some cracking rubber Legend. Bats in the Seven Deadly. Yeah,
yes,
yeah, there isn't there.
There certainly is.
Yeah, lovely covers.
With the rubber bat.
Gorgeous stuff. Absolutely gorgeous stuff. So, couple of questions for you. The one that we prepared before we came on, and we both got one ready to go, is if you could get Brian Lewis to draw, let's wish him he was back alive. If you could get him to draw one movie or one TV program, what would it be? A comic adaptation of?
Oh, for me?
Go on, you go first.
Okay, I'm going to go back to the era that Brian was operating in, which was the 1970s. If House of Hammer had continued and spread its wings into other genres, let's say, or even other horror movies, there's a zombie movie from the 1970s that I love dearly because it encompasses so many things I used to love in the 70s. Crime, cop shows on television.
I know what you're going to say.
Dodgy geezers, hippies, gothic graveyards.
A significant pair of boobs right in the beginning as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Almost
nudity.
No reason. Yeah.
And that film would be The Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue, which I first became aware of within the contents of House of Hammer magazine because they featured a review of this movie with some great photographs. And unfortunately, they gave it a really sniffy review. They gave it a bad review.
Oh, did they? Oh, okay.
But when I was a kid and I saw it, I thought, wow, this is amazing. It's so good.
Yeah.
So I would love it if there was a special House of Hammer magazine dedicated to the Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue, even though they didn't like it at the time, with a great Brian Lewis cover depicting maybe the zombie in the graveyard with holding a stone crucifix, about to clobber the policeman who's on the ground with Ray Lovelock, coming into the rescue with his beard and long hair and leather jacket. And to have Brian Lewis draw that as a strip, I think would kind of like
it has all his
hallmarks. You have a bit of the Sweeney in there. You've got a bit of Seven Golden Vampires kind of in there with the zombies and stuff.
Yeah.
You've got graveyards, people shooting guns and stuff. Some boobs. So that would be it for me.
It's always a good sign when I'm actually mentally exchanging the movie stills for his artwork in my head while you're talking about it. I think that's there's loads in that you could do, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, there definitely is. Yeah, good stuff. No, I loved it. You bought me that film, was it year before last, I think?
And
I watched it over Christmas and I was like, why have I not watched this film before? This is amazing.
It's great.
This is so great. Totally.
I mean,
up
obviously,
my street.
Listener, if you're listening to this, and you're a bit sensitive to certain old fashioned tropes, let's say. It's maybe not the film for you because it's got a character played by Ray Lovelock who's kind of like some kind of weird sexist Doctor Who in that everyone trusts him and gives him information and he's kind of trying to solve this mystery. But he just behaves appallingly to the female character that he's solving this mystery with.
Strange
move over. We don't want to go all the way in reverse now, do we? It's just great. He's got a real mockery accent, which I'd just love to listen to.
Well, mine's kind of on the similar veins, and I got you to watch the trailer for it, didn't I?
Brilliant.
Before we came on, which is called Zeta One from 1969. In the States, it was known as Alien Women, The Love Factor. there you go. It's a British film. James Robertson Justice, who is basically me in a movie, shouting at people a lot. Charles Hawtrey's in it. I remember Charles Hawtrey lived near my gran when I was a kid.
Wow.
And we'd watched Carry On Spying. And we came out of the house and this man walked past carrying a round bottom basket, which we was going to the shops with. And my gran said to me, look, there's that man from the film. And I always, to this day, can remember him from behind walking along with
his weird basket
in his hand. Yeah, yeah. It's got Valerie Leon and Dawn Adams in it. Valerie Leon, obviously a big Hammer horror lady.
Mm-hmm.
And also in high karate adverts and you name it.
Oh, yes.
In the 70s. It's an alien race of women who kidnap 1960s strippers to use as agents. There you go. That's all you need to know about that movie.
So this would definitely key into Brian Lewis's his kind of like sex comedy phase.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
So would you see this more in his kind of like, because obviously Brian Lewis did some, as we talked spoke earlier about,
a little bit saucy, more caricaturish. Yeah. Yeah. What's that one, the name of the one you sent me on DMs earlier? I can't think of the name of it now.
It was called Suki.
Suki, yeah. It's more in the Suki style, I think.
I mean,
it's got a little bit of a spy element to it. I mean, you can tell the shoestring budget their film. One of the hard geezers in it is literally Charles Hawtrey.
Yes.
I put the advert online, other than Russell sent me back saying I didn't expect the Hawtrey.
I would love to see Brian Lewis draw Hawtrey. I think he would capture
the
caricature of that brilliant face of his.
Glasses, thank you.
Yes, but look, if you want to imagine Tony's film choice as a comic strip in terms of style, for mine, look up Seven Golden Vampires, but for Tony's, look up a strip on the internet by Brian Lewis called Suki. And again, listener discretion is advised.
Yeah, she's got a strange nurse's uniform in. I don't think they were even handed out to real nurses.
But she's an air hostess, isn't she?
Oh, she's an air hostess,
Very short. I think HR would have a problem with the length of that skirt.
Someone would get a phone call to that.
Yeah, she's
an
airline pilot.
They keep saying it might...
She's a stewardess working for Yukon Air.
That's right, you told me that.
So, yes.
Yeah, that classic airline. I think that was the precursor to Virgin. Good. We're just going to pause for an advert here. I've got a new sponsor. So we're going to pause for an advert from bored of the same flabby, ugly, sweaty, dirty people in your sex life. Then why not find more at your local swinging club? Take your like-minded partner or brackets prosy to a local house with lots of plastic covered mattresses and squeezy cheese sandwiches and boff people in a spunky hot tub. Let's all be swingers. That's the advert for my new sponsor. Until the Prozzy guy comes out of, I think he's on remand until he finishes on remand. Then we might get those Prozzy adverts back, but that's the current one. Thank you for that. So moving on, thanks for that. That was really good, man. I really enjoyed that. We were talking about another artist that people should know about. Not enough people know about him, but he's like a class act. You know,
he's really brilliant, awesome. And it's just so unfortunate that I would love to see what he would have gone on to, because I'm sure he would have gone on to much more, a household name, comics and books, and it's a real loss to the industry.
Really is, yeah. Now, quickly, just going to see, just catch up, a little catch up with your good self. So I think it's fair to say that we became pals after you came on the show and talked about Surface Tension, a really, really good sort of horror, ecological thriller comic that came out through Titan, 4 or 5 years ago now? 4 years ago?
I'd like to say when it came out as a monthly, it was probably 6 years ago.
Wow. Okay.
I'm so prolific. Yeah.
Now, I've been your pal for a number of years now, and I don't understand video games. In fact, I quite honestly tell you that I've never played one. Apart from I tried to play tennis with my son on the Wii once and wasn't very successful. But you're quite the name in video games as well. And you had the Medieval comic come out.
That's right. Medieval, in case anyone doesn't know, is kind of like a lot of these movies we talk about. I guess in video game terms, it's a strange cult game that has a small but loyal following, and it's over 21, getting up to 22 years old now. But Sony remade it for its 20th anniversary. It came out last year, a year late, in true Medieval style. So we were invited, myself and the co-creator Chris Sorrell, we were invited back to Sony to work on a comic book, and they wanted they told us what they wanted. They wanted a prequel story. I'm not the biggest fan of prequels, if it has to be, truth has to be said. But Chris had an idea for a prequel. He always wanted to tell, but he wanted to do a prequel and a sequel at the same time.
Right, okay.
So in true kind of like, when Chris and I used to work together, things would become very complicated. And we were always, we always aspired so much more. So yes, we created this sequel stroke prequel to Medieval. Which came out last year.
Sorry, did you say this is to coincide with a re-release of the game or a new
The game was remade as a 4K. Everything has to be 4K these days. It was rebuilt from the ground up as a 4K remastered release on PlayStation 4 last year for Halloween. The book was released by Titan Comics. And a bit like Brian Lewis, the style of this book was completely different to Surface Tension, in that Surface Tension was kind of vaguely realistic looking, whereas for this, because Medieval, it's got a very cartoony style to it. I drew it in a very sort of cartoony style, so very different to Surface Tension. So that was quite interesting to kind of go back to an art style that you did 22 years. Well, we started making the game in 1995, so we've been trying to go back to an art style that I had 25 years ago, which is quite interesting.
Right. Both great, man. I've got a print of that you kindly gave me on the wall here from Surface Tension. Yeah, marvellous stuff. Like, brilliant, brilliant book. Yeah, in fact, funny enough, I bought a big chunk of the house, Halls of Horror, when you and I did a road trip to, was it Nottingham Comic Con we went to? Or was it Leamington? I can't remember.
I definitely saw you at Nottingham.
It was Leamington. We shared a lift, didn't we? Yeah. And I bought a chunk of them at that one. Yeah, funny enough. Yeah. So what's next? What's next on the schedule for you, dude?
Well, the reason why I'm not very prolific, I was kicking around a comic based on my teenage years during the coal miner strike of 1984 in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And I wanted to take my experience at that time and turn it into a kind of a monster story set during the 1984 coal strikes. Did that for a couple of years. Unfortunately, I had no traction. So it was an interesting experience. Don't let anyone tell you that everything is possible in comics, because sometimes it's not. And to make the things you really are passionate about, it's very difficult. And the one thing I admire about you, Tony, and people like you, is you do a lot of work through Kickstarters and things like that to get these projects off the ground.
It's becoming very popular, isn't it? Now? I think it's a way that people see how they get their books made. Definitely.
Because it's very hard to get deals, and the one thing you don't want to do is sign away rights to your work. It's the one thing you've got, it's your one asset. and you don't want to give it away for, you know, a free and someone else owns a stake in it. So just be very careful out there when it comes to contracts and publishing deals, listeners. But now I'm working on sort of an evolution of that idea, because my brain just won't let it go. So I'm working on something new, but I don't want to say too much right now. And I'm also working on a horror comic, which I've always wanted to do, because I've never done a pure horror comic. Because even Medieval, which is the game, is based on sort of horror movies. It's a family game, so it's more of a humorous thing.
Yeah.
So I'd like to do a really good horror story. So that's where I am at the moment.
Nice, good. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. We've chatted a little bit about that.
Yes, spoilers, sorry, but, I've been really vague about for obvious.
That's right. That's okay. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, no, there's a work out there of how and when you put information out there these days, isn't there? You don't want to tip your hand too early. You don't want to tip it too late.
Yeah, and I have a very big mouth. If anyone follows me on Twitter, I'm always blabbering about stuff and show things way too early. And you don't want to fall on your face.
Exactly. Yeah. Where's that comic? You don't. I'm drawing it. You know, it's a bit like that. Yeah.
Exactly.
So we need to get in there. Yeah. That's brilliant, mate. Yeah. And so, where can people find you on the socials? Now you mentioned them.
I'm at Gun Comics on Twitter. So if you want to, you know, see me or hear me or read me waffling on about movies like Hammer Horror or Italian Giallo movies or Kung Fu things, it's all there.
Good. And you can find me at neveronanything.blogspot.com. Buy my comics, neveronanything.bigcartel.com. Thanks to everyone, by the way, who pledged to Atomic Hercules. We finished at 214% yesterday, which was brilliant. Thanks to everyone for that. You can follow me on Twitter at Ezohyz. And if you want to listen to a podcast where I shout rude words a lot more than I do on here, go to awesomecomics.podbean.com or on the podcast catcher of your choice. Thanks, man. That's been absolutely brilliant.
Absolute
exactly
pleasure.
What I needed on a Saturday afternoon. And I'll catch up with you soon.
Brilliant. Thanks, Tony. Take care, everyone.
Take care, mate. Bye.